I guess maybe after Adam's talk, mine talk should be titled Size Does Matter for Water Beetles. We're going to see actually a kind of an interesting trend here, hopefully. Before I get too much into it, I usually have to clarify that water scavenger beetles are very poorly named, and that actually not just some of the species of hydrophilids are terrestrial, but actually the majority probably are going to wind up being actually more terrestrial. The habitat all the way on the, or the beetle all the way on the right-hand side actually is a hydrophil that lives in ant nests. And that's about 1.5 millimeters long. So contrast that with the 5 centimeter long hydrophilus species. They also pretty much occur everywhere in between. So if you think of kind of this two-dimensional aquatic to terrestrial landscape, they're really occupying pretty much that entire space at some point in time. A lot of my work has been in looking at how these lineages are able to shift between areas in that landscape. But today's talk is actually going to focus on the hydrophilines, which really have remained stationary, and they have really stayed in open water habitats, and they've kind of really specialized quite a lot in that particular open water area. So the giant water scavenger beetles, as I call them, are now considered a subtribe. They've been a subfamily and everything in between. But the composition has never really changed. There's really 5 genera, about 200 species. They're worldwide, but we see some divisions. Tropisternus, which most of you probably know, is a common New World species, or a genus is about 65 species. Cernulopus is only Old World, and the other 3 genera are cosmopolitan. They go from about 7 millimeters to 50, and it includes all hydrophilids over 15 millimeters are in this group, and really only about 70 species actually get over 15 millimeters. It's not a very large number. So this group is characterized by the typical what you might call sternal keel hydrophil of the hydrophilid character, and this often gets written into keys. You know, hydrophilids have the sternal keel, but these 200 species out of 3,500 are the only ones that have this. So it's not really a good diagnostic character at all. But this group does. So here's a picture. Basically, the mesoventrite and metaventrite are fused centrally and raised. Usually glabrous, sometimes they have spines coming off of them, and they have this sometimes short but often very long, sometimes as the full length of the abdomen, this giant spine. So this kind of project started when I came across this taxon here in the Smithsonian collection, the backlog, and I call this the VZ taxon that's known from Venezuela, but basically you can see it doesn't have an extended spine, even though we have a very distinctive but still primitive fusion of these structures here, and I was like, oh, this is kind of weird. Maybe it's just kind of some kind of missing link taxon or something, linking this hydrophilina group with other things. So I know from one specimen, and unfortunately some of the legs are missing, which turned out to be very important characters for hydrophilids, so I've been twice down there to try to look for it. So far, unsuccessful, but we're still trying. This is actually the type stream for Maruidae, by the way, in case you ever want to see that. And I didn't get this, but I did get 8 genera of Myxophagans on this trip, so interesting. Anyway, so we're going to do a phylogenetic reconstruction on this group. We have 61 taxa, 75 informative characters, and maximum parsimony analysis. This is all adult morphology, by the way. I didn't even bother putting the names on here because you probably couldn't read them anyway, but basically we have a fairly nice tree. Most of the genera come out pretty well resolved. Sternolophus, Tropisternus come out quite well. Hydrochira kind of gets messy because it really doesn't have any character supporting itself. It's kind of been defined on a lack of characters that other things have, so that wasn't totally surprising. The Hydrobiomorpha brownphilus, which is known from like 3 specimens from Syria, is really weird, and it's probably somewhere between Hydrochira and Hydrobiomorpha, and then Hydrophilus comes out. And that taxon from Venezuela does in fact come out to be sister group to the remaining Hydrophilina, and is a new genus, Protistolophus. I'm going to talk about a few of these nodes. Tropisternus is pretty neat, not least in which it has, you know, there are actually 2 or 3 species that are actually not black. This is one of them. Although, interestingly, it has a very similar pattern to the not black Gyrinotaxa, which the yellow margins tend to be, or all the ones that aren't black have these yellow stripes or yellow margins on them. It stridulates using a abdominal elytral stridulation mechanism, but the sclerite, or the third letter of sternite on the side, doesn't have the rough patch on the edge, but it doesn't have an organized file like most hydrophilids that stridulate do, so it's kind of weird. And there was some debate about this, but I finally feel vindicated that the hind tibial spurs on Tropisternus have a synapomorphy where they actually have articulated spines on the spur, if that's possible. I'm not sure, but there you see what it looks like, and you can judge for yourself. So that is actually a close-up of a clearly socketed thing on a spur. So size. So this is a midpoint size range, this midpoint size for each genus. I'm clearly only had about a quarter of the taxa here, so I'm not trying to make that every step along this tree you're trying to increase in size, but we're trying to go for general trends here. I was out of place. So what we see really is a phyletic giantism. So what that is really is a successive size increase occurring in nested clades. So as opposed to just giantism or where you might have this weird core loafer that just kind of pops out and gets really weird, we actually see a successive increase and continuous unreversed increase in size. And so these points A and B are particular nodes at which the smallest member of the derived clade is larger than most of the prior clade. And we're going to look at, so if you want to see what that looks visually, this top little box is the sternolophus and protistolophus and Dropasternus. Hydrochra and Hydrobiomorpha are kind of the intermediate ones, and then of course Hydrophilus are huge. So we're going to look at some morphological changes that occur on these nodes. Sorry about these white lines, they kind of came in here with the rotation, but you can ignore that. So this is an antennal club in this group of this clade. Of all the taxa of this clade A have this, and they have this divided club with long hairs. And the interesting thing is, this is a picture of Hydrophilus down here, but you notice, if you just a little bit of hydrobiology 101, they use this club to make contact with the surface of the water. So you can see here, actually, they've actually folded the club back, and it's actually the cupule that's actually making contact here with the water. So I'm not sure if this is specific to the size, but this is perfectly congruent with this clade, and no other hydrophils have it. There's also a gradual reduction in the pubescence, particularly this is showing on the head. You can see here that the pubescence is, when you get to Hydrobiomorpha and everything is larger than that, you only have pubescence left on the gula, but here it's much more widespread in the smaller ones. And you can see also here, the silver region is where the air, this is actually underwater, but the silver region is where the air is sticking. You have to clearly see how these non-pubescent regions lack the ventral plastron area. And most interestingly, they lack, there's a trend towards loss of this pubescence area on the abdomen. So whereas most hydrophils just have this hydrophage pubescence everywhere, there's been a trend for loss. You can see on this, when you get to the large hydrophilus like this, their entire abdomen there is glabrous, and there's no longer a plastron surface there. So what changes are correlated to node B? What kind of weird things do hydrophilus have? I'm only going to show you two, I think. One is they get extra rows of spines on the ventral surface of the tarsi, and also the males get these actually brushes that come out in between the two rows of spines, which is kind of weird. But most strikingly with Hydrophilus is they get these grappling hook things. So basically, these are the male protarsi, and most hydrophilids have some kind of male modifications on the tarsi, but it's usually a very just kind of a sinuate claw, maybe an extra little basal hook or something like this Hydrobiomorpha. But once you get to the super huge ones, you get these really modified structures, and this is actually a very slight one. Sometimes they look like this. I mean, these giant plates. I mean, this whole one tarsal segment is probably 2 millimeters long. And you see the same trend with some species of Ditissids, where they have the little suction cups. So in Ditissids, what you see is you have actually a suction cup mechanism instead of a grappling mechanism. And also, as Kelly's demonstrated, there's actually a sexual arms race. So the females actually respond to that, those suction cups with grooves and kind of some sort of surface structure. There's no corresponding female modification that I found yet that would correlate to some kind of way to avoid getting these things clamped onto your pronotum. So in some conclusions, most genera appear well-defined and monophyletic, with the exception of this Hydrochra lineage. The Venezuelan taxon is a new genus and is most early diverging. The formation and fusion of the sternal keel appears to have happened first in this group. So the sternal keel is one of the first characters that evolved, and all these subsequent modifications and body size increases happened later. They exhibit phyletic giantism, and the trend in larger body sizes is correlated with some characters, particularly related to respiration and mating. Thank you. As they get larger, they tend to move slightly further. They get more bold in terms of what kind of open water they're going to inhabit. So most of the smaller taxa will be in open water, but usually around weeds. But when you get to the Hydrophilus size, they can be swimming around in open water, presumably because they feel less threatened by fish and other things like that. But that's totally like my just, you know, armchair speculation.
Okay.
And what about the reduction in plastron extent going on?
You know, those 5 centimeter long things must require a hell of a lot more oxygen to move around, and I don't know if it's a matter of like when you get that giant spine and that size and you're swimming so fast that if the air is like not held, it's difficult to hold air there, and I really don't have an answer. I've wondered about that a lot, and I'm not really sure why that's happening. Yeah, it's weird, for sure.
They all may have been really small, and some of them may have become smaller as opposed to larger in different parts of the ground.
So it's what I was looking for was a general trend. So it's very possible that within Tropisternis they might have gone up in size a little bit or gone down a few millimeters, but in the general amount of the tree, like no species of Hydrophilus are less than 25 millimeters long. Whereas the next clade down, none of them are, might be less than 15 millimeters, and they don't get more than maybe 30. So you see these like kind of bracketed changes that are going up.
Have you ever done any
like
reconstructions?
No, not on these.
All right, thank you, Andrew.
Thanks.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes.